Abhipujayami Tamaham สุปาทิปันโนภะคะวะโตสาวกสังโฆโอจุปาทิปันโนภะคะวะโตสาวกสังโฆยะยะปาทิปันโนภะคะวะโตสาวกสังโฆสามิชิปาทิปันโนภะคะวะโตสาวกสังโฆยะติจังชะทาริภุริสายุกานิอัตตภุริสัพพุกัลลาเอสาภะคะวะโตสาวกสังโฆอะหะเนโยอะหะเนโยทักขิเนโยอัญจะลิกะรณิโยอนุตตรังปุญญะเขตังโลกัสสะธัมมังสังฆังอภิปุจจยามิธัมมังสังฆังสิรสานามามิ
And thou goest to the depths Questions this evening. Now we can all go to bed. Oh no, I spoke too soon. Yeah, they multiply at night time from the daytime and all over the place. I'll try and be quicker with the questions tonight. Okay, now just mix them all up. Yes, okay, yes. Okay, good. That didn't have good karma, that one. First question. I've been meditating at home for 10 years. I enjoy it. It makes me happy and more peaceful. Even when my mind seems all over the place. However, when I come here, I get dissatisfied because you talk about jhanas. I think I should get one of those. Could you please talk about fruitcakes instead? Yeah, just give up about jhanas. But there are four fruitcakes. The first fruitcake, the second fruitcake, and the third fruitcake, and the fourth fruitcake. That's what I'm saying. Talk about fruitcakes. But the fruitcakes are depending upon a lot of letting go. Whatever it is, we always want what we don't have. Which means that sometimes when you... There's no end to fruitcakes. That's what I said. Could you please talk about fruitcakes instead? So, when we talk about jhanas, it's when you want them, you never get them. And anyway, you shouldn't talk about fruitcakes this time of night. Because you can't eat anything and you get hungry. So this evening, I'm sure you'll start dreaming of fruitcakes in the middle of the night, and you want, oh, I want a fruitcake. Actually, the cakes and fruitcakes, one of my worst experiences was when I came here to Perth. Because we were really poor at that time. I checked. You know, we had a house, but the house was worth, I checked, it was 50,000 the house was worth. And we owed 49,000 something. We're just keeping our heads above water. So we decided to raise funds, have a cake stall. The trouble was that all our very hard working disciples, they cooked all those cakes and they needed somewhere to put them. We had a Friday night talk in a very small little house, smaller than your cottage, about half the size of your cottages. And so, I was in one room, imagine Jocko was in another room, and the cakes were in the third room. And they smell so delicious. You know when you just have a freshly baked cake? And they left them there. And of course we have our monastic rules, we can't eat them. There's no rule about looking at them and smelling them. And I was in a room right next to the kitchen where they're stored overnight, and I could hardly sleep that night. just a smell of cakes. So I told them, don't do that to us ever again. If you want to do cake stalls, fine, but just keep me in your own house overnight. Anyway, that's my experience of suffering with fruitcakes. How is it that you eat frog rice, do hard labour, but you carry on life as a monk, never giving up and staying happy? It was, I did decide to do a protest. A sit-down protest. I sat down. And I think, oh, you're meditating. Or I decided not to speak anymore. Be silent. And they thought it was even cooler. How can you protest as a monk? Because all the things we do, we can't sort of go on a walk. They're protesting because that's called walking meditation. So everything we do, we just don't know how to sort of protest. I thought of starting a union, a monk's union, so we can go on strike. But then we're not doing very much anyway, so how can we go on strike? Go on a fast. Actually, going on a fast was a very, very good idea when you have to eat frog rice, frog and rice. But anyway, how you stayed happy was, at least I knew from the villagers that they gave us the very best of the frogs. I don't know what frogs they ate, but if we got the best, it must be pretty awful what they had. So it was a good fad. It doesn't last. It's only frogs anyway. But the thing with the frog, there's, you know, sometimes different types of frogs you can eat. You know, you have like the tiny ones that just fat on the little Chinese spoons. But there was just a whole frog. And they weren't fried or sautéed or... they were just boiled. No salt, no garlic, no seasoning, not even any chili pepper. It's as if those poor old frogs just, you know, just by unfortunate chance had just jumped into the pot and got boiled. And we had to eat them. And they just fat on your spoon. So it was 1, 2, 3. Crunch as you crunch the bones. Actually, I did that. It's crazy. I don't know how I did that. But I had to really gross you out. There was a monk sitting next to me. I tell this especially to children, the ones who are still at school or high school, to make sure you pay attention during biology class, okay, Anna? Because if you don't pay attention, this happened to one of these monks. We had the big frogs. Big boiled frogs instead of the small spoon-sized ones. And a big, we only just had one each on top of a bowl of sticky rice. That was the only meal of the day. It was one meal of the day. And as that frog was sitting on top of your sticky rice, after chanting, we started eating it. And of course, you know, you eat the legs first of all. It's like chicken. But it's not enough there. So then you start picking it out at its insides. And this monk sitting next to me, because he didn't know one organ from another one, he actually pressed the frog's bladder. And it still had urine in it. And that frog peed all over his rice. He did! I saw it! And he couldn't eat after that. That was really gross. But anyway, just at least you had good stories to tell other people. I'm not exaggerating, that's what happened. So anyway. How to keep motivated to live well despite life's hardship and sorrows in with Buddha's teachings? Because, yeah, it was simple, but there was something just, you know, it's challenging, but very peaceful. Little things like you didn't know what day of the week it was or what day of the year it was. I remember somebody came to me, one of the villagers, I know, one of the people from town, and said, did you know that your country is at war with Argentina? In the Falklands War. I said, oh, come off it. We don't have wars like that these days. You know, you're mad. It's a joke, isn't it? What's the punchline? And it's actually happening. You didn't know anything which was going on at all. So that, you know, it's hard, I suppose, but simple. It was worth it. What you lost on haute cuisine, you gained on simplicity. So there was trade-offs. And of course, with a very inspiring teacher like Ajahn Chah, and then he was just amazing. Some of the stuff he said, it was really gross, very coarse. Some of the stuff he said, but it made so much sense. Okay, here we go to fruitcakes. When a person has experience out of the body, does it mean he or she has reached the first fruitcake? Jhanas. As experience out of the body, doesn't mean he or she reached the first jhana. No, you just got out of the body. For people that reach jhanas, when they meditate together, do they meet each other in jhana? No. We can make a jhana club. Sorry? Fruitcake, that's more like it. Could a person, because once you get into the jhana, just totally, it's not out of the body, it's beyond the body. And they meditate together, they meet each other in jhana? No. Could a person that have reached jhana become unable to reach jhana again? No. You can actually put it off because of trying. Could you please elaborate a bit on meditation? On the light. Thank you. Yeah, just you see a light. And you enjoy it, don't get afraid. Just be peaceful, it gets brighter and brighter. But it doesn't have to be lights, it can be other things, but the light is usually the most useful. So, please could you say something more about different types of nimittas? Feeling nimittas, screen point nimittas, and which ones are most useful for entering jhana? Oh yeah, there's many types of nimittas, but just the main one is the light. You see other ones, but just see, get in there and see what happens. It has to be enjoyable. The body is disappearing. The body hasn't totally disappeared yet. The body totally disappears when you're in the jhanas. But the body is just so peaceful. And so, it's hardly there at all. And you can hardly hear any sounds. And smells, tastes, touches. All those five senses are being subdued at last. Oh, what bliss to have not these five senses to be worried about. And, oh, this five senses, the reason why a lot of people find it difficult to let go of the five senses, because that's your security. You know, that sometimes one of the last of the senses to shut down is the sound. And the reason is, even in the darkness, you start listening to sounds. What is that? That's protecting you, so you feel. Because on almost one occasion, I was meditating in the jungle. It was pitch dark. And you were meditating there. And in the the early evening, there's lots of, not animals, but insects, the cicadas especially. Once the cicadas calm down, the forest is really quiet in parts of Thailand. So there you were, meditating peacefully. In the stillness of the early evening, early night time in the forest. And then you heard an animal. And as you heard an animal in the forest, you were mindful. Just to check, because there are dangerous animals. There were not just tigers, there were the bears and also elephants. And some of them, you know, just could be dangerous. So you just heard it. Sorry, it's only a small animal. So I just went back to the meditation because the sound is still there. You're still hearing things. And that was like, you know, checking out to feel safe. And then, a couple of minutes later, the sound was sort of getting closer to me. And so I just checked, was mindful, instead of mindful of, I think, of the breath at the time, mindful of the sound. and just checked it, and actually it was not a small animal, it was actually a bigger animal. You could tell by the way it was like crunching the leaves and the twigs, breaking the twigs. It was a bigger animal, but just a medium size, nothing dangerous. So I carried on meditating. And then as it came closer, I could hear my heart starting to beat. And I said, this is not a small animal, this is a big animal. Because, you know, I was judging it in the darkness, just by the sound of it. And I thought, I'd better get my flashlight out and have a look. This must be like maybe a small tiger, maybe even a big tiger. Is that sort of sound? Well, I got my flashlight out and went searching for it with the flashlight. And as I was searching for it, I couldn't see any big animal there at all. Then I could hear it again, and I saw it, a tiny mouse in the forest. And what it really taught me, that the mouse was always that size, but fear had made it huge. It turned a mouse into a tiger. And those are experiences, you've got to be very careful of just how fear amplifies the problem. So, what am I talking about this for? Okay, it's just that's right, sound. So a lot of times we keep sound, or we won't let sound go simply because we're afraid what might happen to us. But there is nothing to be afraid about. In one of the sutras, I think it's in the Majjhima-nikaya, I think, or is it Samyutta? Anyway, major sutra, there was a story of the monk in the forest. This is in the time of the Buddha. And this monk was in the forest, and a couple of villagers were in the jungles looking for herbs or getting some wood or whatever, and they came across this monk sitting there perfectly still. Really still. And they checked on him. Oh my goodness. The venerable must have died in the jungle. He wasn't breathing. Couldn't find any signs of life in him. What do we do next? We can't leave a monk or a nun just to be eaten by the jungle animals. So they thought, they said, well, we can do a cremation. Lots of wood there. And we know a couple of chants. It may not be the right chant, but you know, something, some Buddhist chant they learnt somewhere. So they got the wood. And you know, it's very easy in the forest, lots of wood around, dead wood. They made a pyre, they lifted up the monk, put him on top, and then they did some chanting, Anicca Sankara or whatever it was they did. And then they lit, you know, with the, usually they used, they didn't have matches in those days, it was just a wood to light fires. And then after lighting the fire was burning merrily, and the monk was on top, being cremated. So they thought, well, we've done enough now. So they're busy people. You know, life is busy. You can't spend all day just being distracted by, you know, cremating a monk. You've got other things, important things to do in life. So off they went. And the following morning, they were both shocked and impressed when they saw that very same monk come into their village on arms round. He wasn't burnt. Even his robe, there's no burn marks on his robe. On top of that fire, in the jhanas, he was invulnerable. You can't get hurt in those deep meditations. Fast forward to, was it last year, a year ago? Sorry? No, this was when? Yeah. When I was at this conference in Sri Lanka. Conference in Sri Lanka? Yeah, it was actually the Buddhist Summit conference. And at that conference, they put me up in this small hotel room. And then one of my old friends, you know, calls me one of his disciples, and he follows my meditation technique. And so he said, oh, I've just come to see you. He said, okay, if I can just come up and pay respect to your hotel room. I said, yeah, sure. And he came up there with about 24 people, asking for a Dharma talk and just Dharma discussion in the hotel room. And I thought, it's not exactly what you said you're coming up for, but anyway. that when he was there, it was one of his, one of the members of this little group, who really was a very skilled meditator. And so the leader of the group, he was the doctor. And so he wanted to do this experiment, you know, with, so when this fellow, you know, was in deep meditation, the doctor got out his surgery equipment. This meditator had no anesthetic, and he just swabbed his arm to disinfect it, took out a scalpel, and tried to cut his skin. The scalpel wouldn't penetrate the skin. Couldn't get it in there. So he took him out, you know, when he came out of the meditation. It wasn't hypnosis, it was a meditation. And then afterwards he said what had happened. He said, oh, I didn't feel anything. No wound, no scratch, nothing. And so the doctor said, no, he actually videoed it. He always said he was going to send me a copy of the video, but he hasn't yet. If I see him again, I'll ask him. But the second time, he asked permission from this meditator. Is it okay if I try again, this time with your permission? Yeah. And so, put him in, no, don't put him in, sort of, he started meditating, he got into his deep meditations. And the doctor, you know, with the video on his arm, disinfected the area, took out the scalpel and made an incision. And this time the incision actually cut through. And then, of course, he sewed it up again, put a sterile bandage on it or whatever. And then later on he came out of the meditation, didn't feel anything. And it was just amazing, just an experiment, you know, with a person's approval, that during the deep meditation, unless you give permission, you're invulnerable. Can't be cut, can't be hurt. Weird. Next, another modern case. Any Indonesians here? From Indonesia? Ah, oh, a couple there. Do you remember a monk called, oh, it was Dhamma, wasn't it? Yeah. He's passed away now, which is why I can tell his name. But I met him a long time ago in Bangkok. And he was a monk. He decided to become a rishi, like a hermit. So, in the days when there's lots of jungle and wild areas in Java, in central Java somewhere, he went into this remote area in the hills somewhere, you know, just had long hair, white, you know, had a beard, white clothes, he was just going to be a rishi. And he told me, I remember him, he could speak pretty good English. So he was well educated, and he said that he went into a remote area, found a nice quiet place, sat down across his legs to meditate. And his description of nimittas was interesting, the way he described it. Obviously he was well educated, but you know, his language, English wasn't his first language. So when he said that, he got really, really peaceful. And he said, this star just came into his mind. And that's the most classical nimitta, star. And what he said next, I thought was really, in a sense, cute. The way he said he merged with that nimitta. He said he married that star. Because sometimes when we have like English or whatever language, sometimes the words just don't really fit. And so use something close enough. You know, just really united with that star, married it, he said. And then, when he came out of his meditation, the forest where he was had changed. It was very different than what he remembered when he first sat down to meditate. He didn't know how long, didn't have clocks or anything. And then he noticed that there was lots of damage to the forest. So when he went out and just saw the nearest village, the villagers were very surprised, because where he had been meditating, there had been a flood. And where he was sitting, he must have been under a couple of meters of water. Now for days. He'd been meditating there for 4 or 5 days. Just in his beautiful jhana and not knowing anything which was going on. outside of him. Even submerged in water, didn't need to breathe. Totally safe. And he was a man, because I met him and talked with him, he really was very, very powerful man or monk. But this is one of the problems. If you have powerful things, if you do get any psychic powers, Venerable Chan, you keep them to yourself. Because what happened? There was one of our friends. She was actually a princess. But you know, she was rebellious. She went to Chelsea Art School to rebel. And she married this other English guy who was one of the few people who actually got expelled from Chelsea Art School. You know, people like Mick Jagger went there and just so totally dissolute place. To get expelled from Chelsea Art School in the 60s really must have been something terribly bad. And anyway, that's because that Thai princess was just, he got to know her very well. And she went to these meditation classes he was running in Bangkok, in Wat Bawan. But then one day, that was the last class she ever went to under this monk. Not because she was disappointed with him, because she freaked out when, during the meditation, like the meditations we have here, she felt there's something weird going on. And she opened her eyes and caught this monk, Indonesian monk, with laser beams coming out of his eyes into one of the other meditators. Real juicy psychic powers. Laser lights coming out of his eyes. I said, that was absolutely true. It scared me so much. I got up there and then, you know, bowed and run out of the room, never to go back again. That's the scary stuff. So people say, oh yeah, come on, I said, Bob, show us the psychic power. Come on, you can do it. I promise I won't run out of the room. It's scary stuff. And it's actually real, which is weird. And I'm theoretical physicist, but it really is there. Anyway, so the different types of limiters, but they're perfectly safe. You don't have to worry about anything. You never get harmed or hurt by those things. There is a spiritual movement in Thailand that teaches that there is a Dhamma body or Dhammakaya inherent in a person, and the goal of meditation practice is to uncover this Dhammakaya. Is that consistent with Buddhism? The head guy is on the run from the police. And there's many different cults, many different societies, many different types of teachings of Buddhism. But that particular one, it's just notorious, you know, but just how it's focused on money and power. And that's one of the reasons they're incredibly wealthy. And, oh, there was just a fellow over here in Perth who came up to us one day. Well, actually, we were going to visit by the Dalai Lama in the old Perth, was it the entertainment centre? The dome thing. Anyway, and he saw the monks on the train go to this, and he came up to say, he said, look, you know, that I was interested in Buddhism, and I went to their temple in a different part of Perth, and after 3 or 4 days, they came up to me and said, you know, you've been coming to see us a long time, it's about time you gave a donation. He said, oh, okay, I'll put $10. He said, no, $10,000, please. And he said, it was crazy. They were just asking for huge amounts of money to send back to Thailand. So it became notorious because of that. And, of course, they soon found out there's a lot of corruption going on. And because of that, eventually the police raided the big compound. And that monk just disappeared, stood on the run. So sometimes people can be very impressive, give good talks, but if you want to see where I live, and it really is where I live, apparently it's on Friday after lunch, isn't it? Friday after lunch, you're invited to visit my bedroom. And my meditation room. And where I hang out. Which is a little cave. And you go and have a look. And that's real. That's where I live. So I try and keep things simple. Dear Ajahn, is enlightenment a sensation at the end of your practice, or is it in different areas of the practice? For example, in the times when there are no thoughts. If there are no thoughts, how can you think that you're enlightened or not? So, instead of enlightenment, call it awakening. Are you awakened or not? So, sometimes you get some nice quiet times and lots of bliss, and you have these great understandings of the nature of this world. And that happened to me on my fourth. This is, I've already said it. The time I got enlightened. Oh my goodness. Well, I've started now, so I might as well continue. This is a story of when I became enlightened. So, my fourth rains retreat. It's that same monastery of that monk I said when he would give a talk, he'd fall asleep, and he'd carry on precisely where he left off. And he didn't need to like cutting a sort of a video. He didn't need to sort of splice it. It was just, in fact, amazing. It was weird. But anyway, it was a good place, nice and quiet. And one evening I was really getting into the meditation. Walking meditation, sitting, and sometime you just really, just hit the sweet spot of meditation. And meditation was really going. Walking meditation, and especially when I was doing the walking meditation, all these amazing insights came up. I mean, really amazing. You can understand things. And, sometimes you wonder, why didn't you see that before? And then maybe about 11 p.m., the big one hit. Real ultimate insight. Wow, that was it. You just imagine how it feels to become enlightened. So much joy. So much bliss. Freedom, at last. No more striving or doing anything. You're there. Oh, that was so wonderful. And you were walking and you're meditating. No sleepiness. Just whenever you want to close your eyes, it was just, you were there. And then I thought, well, the bell usually went at 3 o'clock. It was getting about 2 a.m. in the morning. I thought, I better lay down. So I lay down. No sleep, of course. Maybe half an hour just to relax the body. In the hall at 2:30, before the bell had gone. And then meditating. This was in the jungles. It was hot. It was humid. Lots and lots of mosquitoes, but you're sitting there, perfect posture. And the chanting time, you chant in Thai, perfect pronunciation. Full of energy. And it's just, everything was just so easy and perfectly done. And then of course we had our arms round. And as I was walking on arms round through the village, I was just giving so much metta to every layperson. These poor villagers were giving a tiny piece of rice to one of the newly enlightened monks. How lucky they were. And as I blasted everyone with metta, when I came back to the monastery, it was a very simple monastery. And usually we had the same food for one meal every day. It was rice, not the frogs. Sometimes you had frogs in the season, but this was usually the rotten fish curry, the plat ek. And that rotten fish, I mean, it really did stink. How it worked was, during the rainy season, any extra fish, because lots of fish around in those days, and during the rainy season, so the extra, they put it in bowls to pickle it, to keep it for when they were short of protein. But the pickling was so basic. They just put them in these earthen jars and got a bit of plastic and covered them. So it was really unhygienic and really stinky, but they were really into this. So every day it was rotten fish curry and sticky rice. But this day, when I came back from Arms Round, I noticed there were two pots of curry there. Not just the usual rotten fish curry, there was another pot there. And that was, you know, pleasing it. I was a vegetarian before I became a monk, but over there there was no vegetables. Literally no vegetables at all. And so the other one was a pork curry. And that actually was edible. It must have come from town. I thought, wow, it's very rare to get this curry. Ah, the heavenly beings had found out that I was newly enlightened, and they were celebrating my enlightenment. And so, the two pots of curry, there's only about 5 monks in this monastery, and the abbot, the head monk, sort of, you know, he was from that village, that's what he was doing there. And he, you know, we had our sticky rice first of all, enough rice there. And then he took the first saucepan of curry, the pork curry. And you wouldn't believe how many ladles he put in that, in his old alms bowl. No one could eat that much of the pork curry. But I thought, it doesn't matter, I was number two in line. There's plenty left for me and the other monks. But what he did next, really, I never saw coming. He took the big pot of stinky, almost inedible, rotten fish curry, and he poured it into the first pot of pork curry. He stirred it up, saying, "It's all the same. It's all the same." And I thought, you bloody hypocrite. If it's all the same, why didn't you mix it up before you took yours? Instead of, you know, taking yours first and then mixing up, say, "It's all the same, it's all the same." Yeah, you just said, "Oh, my teacher, you know, that is not on you." And that's when I realized, when you're enlightened, really enlightened, you don't worry about such things. You certainly don't get upset and angry. My enlightenment only lasted a few hours. And if you've ever been depressed, I think one of the biggest depressions you could ever have is thinking you're enlightened and you're realizing you're suddenly not. That was just really a bummer, big time, as I used to say. You know, afterwards, I didn't care what I ate. Bunged it in and passed it down the line. I was depressed. I was upset. That was my enlightenment story. The time I got enlightened and it wasn't real. So that sometimes you can get these nice experiences and think, oh yeah, this is it. But then what happens? You try and eat some rotten fish curry mixed up with everything else after everyone else has taken theirs. Then you find out if you're enlightened or not. Dear Ajahn, what is the ultimate objective of meditation? The ultimate objective of meditation is not going anywhere. Being here. Ultimate means over there. I know the ultimate. There's always something beyond the ultimate. It's just like sometimes when I go to these conferences, they call people venerable. Sometimes most venerable. And then you hear ultimately most venerable. Extremely most venerable. Unsurpassable venerable. They always up, you know, the ultimate, more than ultimate, super ultimate, post ultimate, or whatever you call it. That's the trouble with extremes. You can always get something higher than infinity. So we have this the real a way to designate different stages of your monk life, just by your age. After 10 years as a monk or as a nun, they call you Tara. That means like an elder over 10 years. When you become 20 years as a monk, you have the title Mahatera. And that's it. It stops. And I thought, that's really unfair. I've now been a monk 45 years. I'm still the same as people who are just 20 years. So I thought, we can't allow this. We have to just, yeah, it's okay, Tera and Mahatera. And I thought, after 30 years, what do you become? Megatera, yes. Tera, Mahatera, Megatera. And after Megatera, Gigatera. And that explains my sense of humour. Giggle-terra. And of course, after 50 years, you're a terra-terra. A real terra. Anyway, the ultimate objective of meditation is actually just losing all ideas of objectives. When I was falling asleep at home one time, I found that my body had fallen asleep, but my mind is awake. After a few moments in that curious state, I heard two persons speaking and they said, "She's awake." And I realized they knew I'm awake. Soon afterwards, I regained bodily awareness and woke up in bed wondering if the two persons I overheard were spirits, as I have no one else close by. Is this similar to a meditative state? Is this what astral projection is? What is called astral projection real? Oh, look. I can't answer that question. But if those were two persons speaking, who said she's awake, why didn't you talk back at them? Have a nice conversation. Hi, how are you? Because spirits or ghosts or other, they are very interesting. I always thought you could make one of the most popular articles in the whole world if you did an in-depth interview of a ghost. Because there's so many unanswered questions. Like, ghosts usually come out at night time, so what do they do during the day? Where do they go? Where do they hide? They only come out at night time. And also, like, do ghosts get married? Do they fall in love? Nice young male ghosts and nice young female ghosts, they meet one another, and as I'll meet you in the cemetery tomorrow night. And they hang out together, and they just have a nice time, and eventually, when they fall in love, they decided to go and get married and spend the rest of their time in purgatory together, and maybe even just have little baby ghosts. Can you have, like, an animal become a ghost? Like a ghost dog or a ghost cat? Can you? So, I was thinking, what a wonderful thing. How do ghosts feel? What do ghosts eat? Rotten fish curry? So sometimes, I think it's really interesting. Don't be afraid of ghosts, ask them questions. But the one question is really good to ask them. Sorry? No, really good to ask them. Because this was the story of the tsunami ghost in Krabi in Thailand. You know, during the tsunami, the Christmas Day tsunami, many people lost their lives. And in the town of Krabi, which is on that sort of that gulf, it wasn't really affected too much, it was a bit too far away. But a Thai girl had this dream in the middle of the night. And in the dream, she saw this white girl, now 19, 20, in like, you know, in a bathing bikini or whatever, blonde hair, but all bloody and cut and gashed. And she was in a dream saying, "Help me, help me, I'm dead." A ghost in a dream. "Help me." I was on Phi Phi Island when the wave hit. I'm dead. My mother is in London. Right now she's trying to contact me, but my cell phone is in the bottom of the ocean. Help me. And she said, this is my name. Right now my body is being stored in one of the temples in Phuket Island, which acted as temporary morgues. She said, you'll find me in this monastery, gave the name. And can you please give me a Buddhist funeral? And tell my mother not to come yet. I don't want her to see me like this. And tell her to come after the funeral so she can collect the ashes. And this is my mother's telephone number. It was one of these dreams. This is actually a true story. She remembered everything. Once the telephone number, even the telephone number, digits. Now, why did this girl have that dream? They weren't related at all. No, this was a Thai girl. This was an English girl. But I always feel, they never said this in the story, that the reason why was because she was married to an English man. So, you know, she woke him up and told her what the dream was. And the first thing, apparently, that the English man recognized, that was a London telephone number. And so he said, well, just ring it. Maybe true. You know what the Thai girl did? Because Thais are so afraid of ghosts. He said, no, you ring it. And of course, it turned out to be the mother of that girl. That name. And the mother said that, you know, she had just been trying to call. There's no signal at all. But the mother knew, like mothers sometimes do know, that the child was dead. You know, you feel that sort of a close relation, you know, something's really terribly wrong, she hasn't made it. And so she said, yes, please, follow her wishes. And so the next morning, they drove to Phuket. It was mayhem, obviously. And they got to that temple, she knew where the temple was. She went inside, and you could get permission because, again, they couldn't do all of the checks and balances. But when she went in there, she recognized the dead body exactly as she'd seen in the dream. So gave it the name and arranged a cremation, because they had to do things very quickly. Hot climate, things would go very, very nasty if you kept dead bodies and they didn't have enough freezers to keep them. She rang her mum. Her mum got on a flight, met, and this Thai girl and English husband gave the ashes. They embraced, they cried. The job had been done, and they felt so wonderful that they could do something to help. So, when they got back home to Gubbi, in the middle of the night, she had another dream. And in that dream, the girl came to her for the second time, the second only time. But this time, her complexion was totally different. It was like she had been to a salon and had a makeover. Her hair was perfect. She was wearing a white, radiant dress. And in the dream she said, look what you've done for me. Thank you so much. Look at me. Deva, heavenly being. Said, I don't know how to thank you, but anyway, here are some more numbers. And this was true. But it wasn't a telephone number, it was a lottery number. And they bought the ticket and they won a lot of money. So the moral of that story is, if you do ever see a ghost, don't run away yet. Ask the number first, then run. Anyway, but it's weird sometimes. So you had two persons speaking, they said, she's awake. You miss your opportunity. Say, numbers, please. Anyway, whatever. So a meditative state, similar to a meditative state. Astral projection, I was talking to someone the other today about that, astral projector, even have that in Buddhism, mind-made body, manomayakaya, so people can leave their body sometimes, but if you do leave the body, again, it's number one, after a few times, you're fed up with that, you've been there, done that. The only time when I thought it was useful was this fellow over in Karnak Prison Farm many years ago, and he told me his story, because I taught meditation there, and these people come and learn, listen to your meditation teachings. And he said he was from former Yugoslavia. And as a kid, you know, he was really sick, and he was given this operation on, you know, in the hospital, and he died on the operating table. And he floated out of his body, he said, and he said he saw the doctors or whatever, the nurses, panicking because, you know, he was dying or dead. And he knew intuitively they were looking at the wrong part of the body. That was not what was causing this death. And even though he was only 6 or 7 years of age at the time or something, you know, he just willed to say, "Doctors, look over here." And one of those doctors looked over there. There it is. And they healed the problem, so he survived. He said from that time on, he could always, you know, astral travel whenever he wanted to. He could leave his body. And he said what was really helpful was, I don't know why he was in jail, he never said, but when he was in jail, if everyone wanted to see a football match live, or a concert, or go and see a movie, which wasn't allowed inside the jail, he'd just be in his cell. He'd leave his body and go watch the movie or go watch the football match live. Didn't need to pay any tickets. And when it was finished, come back home again into prison. He didn't mind being in prison. The walls couldn't keep him in. The way he said it, I thought it was really cool, I suppose. Anyway, other than that, you know, that sometimes you think, why do people do that? Because it's an invasion of privacy if they go to see somebody. So best to keep that out. I mean, only a few people can do that. A lot of time they get scared if it happens the first time. They don't know what to do. Anyway, what do you do if one suddenly keeps getting bad dreams throughout the night for the past few nights during this retreat? Is it karma? I think I mentioned this to someone in the interview. It's not karma. It's just, you know, maybe just having some bad ideas when you first go to sleep at night. And what I told them is, before you go to bed, one of the important things, and do some body meditation, relax the body. So any sort of tightness, any sickness or bit of imbalance in the body disappears. So at least your body is nice and peaceful. And then just have a look in the mirror just after brushing your teeth or whatever you do before you go to bed. And smile at yourself, make a face and laugh. And then go to bed. Go to bed with a laugh on your face. There's no way you can have bad dreams after that. How can I have a positive self-esteem without being proud of myself in terms of my inner strengths? I have a lot of faith in myself most of the time, and I don't think I can achieve what I want to. Look, it's sometimes people always feel that if you're proud of yourself and you say amazing things about yourself, you get a big head. You don't get a big head. If you respect yourself, you get a big heart. So that's one of the reasons why sometimes I get these awards. And one of the first awards I got over here in Australia was this John Curtin Medal. And I went there to Curtin University and they gave me this prestigious medal, and in the newspapers afterwards, and when he had to give an acceptance speech, my speech was, I don't know why you gave this to me. There's other people in the community who do much more than I do. And I couldn't have done it without the help of my friends anyway. But thank you anyway. I think I don't deserve it. And then the next year, somebody else got the award. And actually just a couple of weeks ago, that I love going to this awards ceremony because it's amazing people get these awards. People actually go under the radar but do wonderful things. And the person who got the award this year, you know, he was an amazing fellow. He was a young man, his first name was Leif, and he had learning difficulties when he was young. He really struggled to get through school. But he had really good teachers encouraging him. Eventually he got to university, you know, later than most people. And then he was put under the wing of this, doing applied sciences and evolution theory and the primates. And after graduating, he got a job in Perth Zoo as looking after the orangutans. And he had this amazing sort of connection with animals, maybe because of his learning difficulties, I don't know what. But, you know, he really sort of excelled at this position. He became the head orangutan keeper in Perth Zoo. He just jumped up and down and just stood his ground and protested until he could get a better enclosure for the orangutans. And he got there, raised a bit of money, and got a really good, appropriate place where the orangutans in captivity could at least have something of a decent life. But he also, again, he was just a pain in the neck for people because sometimes the baby orangutans were so cute. They got sometimes taken to shopping centres, you know, to promote products or something. Or promote some wildlife fund. And you know, he was, you know, close enough to the orangutans in that person, he realised that bond between a mother orangutan and her son or daughter was really strong. And separating them by taking them just for a couple of hours to a zoo was causing huge amounts of problems. So he stopped that. And then more research found out that orangutans in captivity, they're very unhealthy psychologically and they really do need to be taken back into the wild, to be trained. And he was taking them back into Sumatra, in Kalimantan and Sarawak. That was East Malaysia and Borneo, or Indonesia, Kalimantan, in the jungles there, making sure they're okay. And he became like an expert. He started the Orangutan Project, which has now got millions of dollars to provide proper habitat for orangutans. Almost brought them back from extinction single-handedly. And I was listening and thought, wow, that's amazing. What a wonderful thing he's done. And then he goes up there like everybody does these days and says, I don't know why you gave it to me. There's other people doing much better work than I'm doing. I could have done this without all my friends and supporters, but thanks anyway. Every year they say, give the same acceptance speech. And I learned a lot from that. I get inspired and I go up to him and say, you deserve that. I said, no, I didn't. And he said, you deserve yours. I said, no. Why is it that you contemplate this and a lot of very smart people at university, they look at these people who have been nominated and they don't give it to people because you give them some money or because people seek these things. They have a look and they judge and they say, yeah, you deserve it. And I think everybody in that room, except for Leif, was sure he deserved that award. Why is it that when we get an award or praise, we think we don't deserve it? That's nothing, I don't worry about that. So after I figured out what was going on, I tried to tell people and encourage them. If you get an award or a praise, you go up there and in your acceptance speech say, thank you very much, I deserve that. Why are you laughing? Because it's not done, is it? You don't say that, no, thank you very much, well done. You say, no, I don't deserve it. Which means you totally disrespect that panel of judges who actually thought you did deserve it. You totally disrespect all the people who think, wow, what great leadership, what great example, great sacrifice. Good on you. Well done. So it's strange. We never accept praise. Criticism, oh yeah, we can accept criticism. yeah, you know, you just tell the same old joke every year and something like that. Oh yeah, I'll try better next time, honestly. Criticism we accept. Praise we just brush off. And because of that, we get depressed, miserable. We never think we're good enough. And also, our happiness is not as much as it should be. Leaf, well done, you did an amazing job. You should be so proud of your achievements. Well done. And if you feel good about your achievements, you actually want to do more. Not less. Anyway, that's positive self-esteem. So go for it. Little Chandra, you haven't finished Anukampa yet. But you've done so much already.
Yes.
Yay. Great pioneering bhikkhuni. Do you deserve that?
Yeah.
On record. But sometimes we think of all the things we haven't done. Think of all the things you have done, and you feel good about yourself. And woo. Hi. How's it going? How does the seven factors of awakening lend to ultimate realization? The factors start from sati, mindfulness, and end with upekkha, or equanimity. In the fourth jhana, there is pure equanimity and mindfulness, in which a practitioner could contemplate the workings of the mind. No, they can't, not in fourth jhana, because it's too equanimous. You're too still. You can't contemplate anyway. You're poised. Still. The spider in the middle of the web, not moving. People might think you're dead, but you're just there. It's when you emerge afterwards, after those deep meditations, that's when your contemplations happen. That's when you're full of energy. Anyway, let's see Anacchadukkha Anatta. Let's stop the process of bhava and mental. You don't stop the process of bhava. The bhava stops itself. You don't do it. It just happens. I remember this from the Buddha's instruction to Pukkhasati the ascetic in the potter's shed. Is that the purpose of jhana and the bojanga? Be careful of translations. That's why, in the end, I always prefer seeing it in the Pali. And also, this was some advice given to me by Venerable Jnana Tiloka, this old German monk who did many translations. And I had some beautiful good fortune when I went to Sri Lanka the first time. I went up to the forest hermitage, and there you saw Bhikkhu Bodhi and Venerable Jnana Ponika, and Venerable Jnana Ramata was there as well. And there we were just having a nice chat in the evening about many, many different controversies in the suttas. And Venerable Jnana Ponika is towards the end of his life. And for those of you who ever think that Bhikkhu Bodhi is just a scholar, that I remember just being so impressed. He was looking after this Jnana Ponika, just like a mother would look after a child, like a son would look after such a loved father, with such devotion, and it would just really move me. I always thought scholars were detached. They had such amazing loving kindness and care to this old monk who was his mentor. And anyway, this Jnana Ponika, Venerable Jnana Ponika, he just said something. You never interpret the teachings of the Buddha in light of one or two obscure passages. There's always some passages which are difficult to translate. You interpret the obscure passages in light of many of the repeated, often stated teachings of the Buddha. Not the other way around. Because otherwise, you can always find a bit of an ambiguous passage here, ambiguous passage there, and you interpret the whole of the teachings in light of that. instead of actually the whole teachings, Eightfold Path, Jhanas. There's so many of those teachings. They're repeated so often in sutra after sutra after sutra after sutra after sutra. And those are the ones you use as your guide to interpret the ones which are a little bit unclear. When my husband told me about his bad experience with people at work, I'll try to give different view of the situation. He would end up angry with me and accuse me of siding with the bad people at work. Should I just keep quiet and let him continue to say and think unwholesome? How to help him without him feeling worse? You use the sandwich method. First of all, you empathize with him. So, oh, that's terrible what you have to do at work. You work so hard, you sacrifice so much to, you know, feed the family or whatever. But, oh, the bad experience with people at work. I mean, why do they treat you like that? So you get him on side, first of all. That's the bread in the top slice of the sandwich. And then you give him the teaching. But you know that people are like that sometimes. Or, you know, that, and what can you do about it? Getting angry at them, you know, that's not going to help you. There must be some other way we can deal with this. No, you've finished work now, so don't take it home with you by remembering all those bad experiences. They've hurt you once. Why do you allow them to hurt you again in the evening? This is your time. And then afterwards, say, well, have a good night's sleep, relax, and who knows, maybe we can think of something to do in the morning. So you're empathizing with him, but also you're teaching him a little bit of Dhamma. Just, you know, why do you allow other people what they did to create unhappiness in you? A couple of years ago, we had a burglar came into our workshop and stole a lot of expensive tools. So what do we do? Bad karma! Stealing from monks! Oh, terrible! You know, we have to get that burglar and just teach him a lesson or whatever. I said, no, come on. They can steal your possessions, but don't let them steal your precepts. Don't let them steal your happiness and peace and forgiveness. That's something I would never allow anyone to steal. And anyway, it was good karma. Because when we checked out what was stolen, it was getting a bit old, and we checked out the insurance, it was all covered by insurance. Of course, you have to pay the excess. We don't actually pay the excess. That's taken off how much money you get back. With all the money we got back from these stolen tools, we got new tools. They were cheaper and much more efficient. And so afterwards, it was amazing. We actually got a little bit extra money out of it. You know, we're paying the excess and getting the old tools, clunky old tools, and get some really new ones, much better. So we were so impressed. We were really trying to find out the name of that burglar to invite him back again. And I said that story too often, and sometimes they don't tell the insurance company. Otherwise, they say when it gets burgled again, they say, did you ask him to come back this time, Ajahn? So that's actually what is, oh yeah, actually from the person who is at work feeling worse. Well, you know, sometimes people do bad things, but don't let them control your happiness. People get stressed out sometimes. You do so much and then someone comes and makes it worse for you by doing something bad or making big mistakes. Oh yeah, but that's life. I read an article by a famous USA monk that the best optimal level of samadhi should be that there is some degree of mental clarity and joy, yet the mind is not too absorbed or concentrated to block off all awareness, as in jhana. You don't block off all awareness. You have the awareness of stillness. Already mentioned, the ultimate awareness, the purity of equanimity and mindfulness, is in the fourth jhana. That's the highest awareness you can have. He quoted, he quoted from his first Thai teacher, the late Ajahn Phung, on his teaching. My meditation teacher, following the US monk, teaches the same way too. If jhana is absorption and block of all sensory awareness, how is the mind going to contemplate? Okay. The story of the tadpole. Are you sitting comfortably? Then I'll begin. Once upon a time, in a retreat center similar to where you are today, there was a little tadpole who was born in the pond, in the lake. And she was a very smart little tadpole. This was in a very advanced little retreat center. They even had education for the life in the pond. So little tadpole went to grade school and then eventually to university, where she excelled in chemistry. And she majored especially her dissertation in the nature of water. She became an expert in water. And because she was in the pond of a retreat center, every now and again there would be a Burmese sayadaw would come and she would hear Abhidhamma. She knew everything about water, even the nature of the water as one of the elements. But how could a tadpole who was born in the water, spent all her life in the water, knew nothing itself except for being in water, really understand what water is? Doesn't matter how many teachings, how many books, how many lessons, you cannot really understand what water is. No more than a fish can understand what water is. But the difference between a fish and a tadpole is one day a little tadpole starts to grow four appendages, little legs, and little arms. She doesn't really know what's going on. But those legs and arms go bigger and bigger and bigger until little tadpole is becoming a frog. And one day, not really knowing what she's doing, she jumps. She's out of the lake, squatting on dry land. That's one of the weirdest things she's ever experienced. Nothing in her life has been like that. Something which had always been there is now absent, missing. Water. Now she has direct experience of water being absent. So now she knows what water is. When it's always there, you miss it. You can't know what it is. But once it disappears, now you understand what water is. So in this simile, even the nature of the five senses, a doctor, a psychologist, a neuroscientist can write essays about the body, five senses. How can they know what they really are when they've been in there all the time? That's one of the reasons why when the Buddha says you get nibbida towards even the five senses. What are you talking about? That's really negative. Monks like you, Ajahn Bhav, should go and see a therapist and get a life. You're too negative. Life is good. Come on, what are you afraid of? Go out there and get married. Go out there and start a degree. Why are you so afraid of life? You should get out there instead of staying as a monk. What are you afraid of, Ajahn Bhav? So, because they don't understand just what it's like when the five senses vanish. When you come back again afterwards, my goodness, you realize they are suffering. And that's only the first time outside the lake. Only when you're outside the lake. And of course that refers to the jhanas. In the jhanas, that's when something which has always been there is gone. In the first jhana of the five senses, now you can understand what they are. Once they're gone. And the second jhana, that's even more weird. In that second jhana, the thing which is gone, unmistakable, is your will choice, chetana, whatever you want to call it, that's no longer there. Now that is one of the weirdest things. People have all these ideas of what will is, who chooses, why you chose to do what you want to do. And it's one of the things you guard as one of your closest possessions. You'll never allow anyone else to make choices for you or tell you what to do. That's called dictatorship. That's called lack of freedom. The first freedom which you'll always guard is the freedom of will. It's my choice how I live my life. I decide what I want to do. I decide if I don't like to listen to Ajahn Brahm, I can walk out any time. And you guard that freedom. But when you find, when that will disappears, you understand what the will truly is. That really shakes you up. So how do you actually understand what the will is? You're out there, you're on that ledge outside the lake. You can't really do anything yet. But when you hop back into the lake, when you come out of the jhanas, the upachara states, the neighborhood, what is before and after the jhanas, those are the states where you use the experiences of the jhanas. That's your data. Weird, strange, but true experiences. Use that data. With a very clear, courageous mind, you just experience something and you're very bright, then that's where the insight happens. I always remember Ajahn Chah teaching jhanas, encouraging jhanas, but sometimes, I think it's called even like, they call it gaslighting now, sometimes people say, no he didn't. I say, well, didn't I not hear it correctly? Have I changed my understanding? Is it my memory is faulty of what Ajahn Chah taught? So it was a year or two ago, I went up to see an old friend, Ajahn Jayasaro. He was the one who did the translation of Ajahn Chah's biography, was it called Still Water Flowing? So, you know, he compiled everything, translated it, what was already translated, added a bit more. And so, you know, basically he's the expert on Ajahn Chah's life. So, you know, he's a bit junior to me, 5 years. But, you know, he really respects me. And he wanted to actually to just check, because I was 9 years with Ajahn Chah, to actually check a few things. Did this happen? Did this happen? What was your take on this one? And so I could actually add some information there. But then I asked him the question, did Ajahn Chah teach jhanas? Because I always remember he did, but people say he didn't. He said, oh yeah, he taught jhanas. But he used the Abhidharma term, the commentary term, apana. But you know, that's the term for jhanas. It's just same thing, different designation, different name. And then I asked him, what about the insight, enlightenment? And then without any prompting, good old Ajahn Jayasaro said, exactly as I remember, exactly as I teach, he said, there are two places where the enlightenment insights happen. The just before jhana or just afterwards. But he said the ones after jhana are the most common places where your contemplation, your insights come to the point where you can actually break through and just stages of enlightenment happen. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. I was not deceived by time that this is how I remember him. So, that's where the insight happens, according to Ajahn Chah. That's how I teach. That's how the Buddha teaches. That in the jhanas, indeed, that gives you the data. That gives you the power. And with that data and power, there's a huge chance of getting through. Nati jhanang apanyasa. I think this is verse 274, Dhammapada. There is no jhana without wisdom. Panya nati ajayato. There is no jhana without wisdom. There's no wisdom without jhana. But yam hi jhanang cha panya cha. When there's jhana and wisdom, sove nibbana santike. You are in the presence of nibbana. You're so close. Jhanas and wisdom go together. And when they come together, you're very close. Maybe I'll get some of those sequences tomorrow, which shows that there's no seeing things as they truly are without the jhanas. That's a cause for seeing things as they truly are, for wisdom. May I know what is the bodhisattva path? Heard so much about it, but don't really understand. Can you please clarify it? The bodhisattva path in the suttas, they only call Siddhartha Gautama the bodhisattva from the time descending from the Tusita realm until the time sitting under the Bodhi tree just before enlightenment. It's only applied to him just in his the first part of his last birth. Later on, they had the idea of a bodhisattva. And this is my view, please don't be offended by it, but it's late. Coming after the time of the Buddha, there was controversies, the first 5 points of controversy which was recorded, was centered around if a person is an arahat, fully enlightened, can they regress afterwards? And where this is coming from is that if you are especially a teacher and people start calling you an arahat, fully enlightened, it's a bit of a downer when they find you making mistakes. So what's going on? Weren't you enlightened, or were you enlightened and then you regressed again? And if you weren't enlightened, then why should I support you? It was the case, and it's true, that you get more bang for your bucks if you give dana, if it's to an enlightened person. And that was so obvious and really sort of hurt on this occasion. When the first year as a monk, wok ba pong, frog on rice, rotten fish curry, and one day, waiting in the dining hall, looked through the window, and a car came in from the city, the regional capital, Ubon, Rajatani. Because there was had lots of pots of food in the back. Nice food again, lots of them, and sweets and bananas and really delicious food. I thought, wow, I was a young monk, only 23, 24, gonna eat well today, yeah. And then the guy, the driver came in and noticed Ajahn Chah wasn't there. He said, where's Ajahn Chah? Oh, he's off at a ceremony in town. Oh, really? So he got in his car and drove away. It wasn't worth offering food to me on those other monks, but to Ajahn Chah, you get so much back for your donations from him. And that's one of the reasons why that, and it says that in the suttas, giving to an arahat is better than giving one to an ordinary Jojo monk. So, that's one of the reasons why we never let on who's enlightened, who's not. Because otherwise, unenlightened monks, they're getting there, unenlightened nuns or whatever, they're getting there, but they need food as well. And in fact, the Buddha actually said it's much better to give to the whole Sangha rather than any individual monk. He said that Sangha, both monks and nuns as well, that's the best. So that's one of the reasons why we don't get special stripes on our shoulders. First jhana, one stripe, second jhana, one stripe, third jhana. In enlightenment, a pip on here and a different sort of peak cap or something if you're an arahat. We all wear the same stuff, so you don't know who's who. So then the bodhisattva path came up afterwards as an alternative. It gets so hard to give up all these things. So some people, if they're not making it as an arahat, would be a bodhisattva as well. I'll become enlightened in my next life. I remember reading Alexandra David Neal, and she said, you know, she was in Tibet a long time ago, and she wrote this very funny scam which was going on amongst the monks. Please excuse me, this was, you know, 56, no, more than that, maybe 80, 90 years ago, I think. But anyway, Alexandra David Neal reported, she saw this many times, there'd be an old monk looking after, you know, a district. And after many years of practice, middle-aged monk, he was getting a bit sort of tired of being a monk. And being a man, started getting sexual fantasies and stuff. And so, he went to the village and he gave the sermon saying, you know, I'm really close now to full enlightenment. This is probably going to be my last life. I'm not coming back again. And he said, you can't do that. You have to come back again to look after us in your next life. Now please come back. You can't leave us like this. Now be a bodhisattva. Come back. Don't become enlightened. Don't become an arahant. And he would say, well, you know, I'd have to do something really, really bad, you know, to stop my enlightenment now. Please, venerable sir, do something really, really bad. It was a total scare. And so I said, well, no, I can't. He said, oh, please, please, out of compassion for us, do something really bad, the worse the better. So you have to keep coming back again. Well, this girl over there was very nice. Please! So he disrobes and gets married, doesn't have to do any job, and they all think he's so compassionate. No, to follow his lust, so he can get reborn again. You see, that was a total scam. And people bought it. So be careful about those scams. My meditation teacher, a lady from a family of pious Buddhists, including her husband's sister, told the class that the concept of jhana is the most controversial today in today's Buddhism. Well, it certainly wasn't controversial in the time of the Buddha. It's on every page. She teaches that rather than focusing on which level of jhana one has had, one should have a certain level of stillness and using that stillness to contemplate all phenomena as anicca, dukkha, anatta. Is that the same person before? The practice of merely jhana would instead lead one to be reborn in the form where one gets stuck there. Is this correct? My goodness, that is gomayan. Why did the Buddha teach? This is Nagopaka Moggallana Sutta. And just after the Buddha passed away, Ananda was a go-to person. He'd been with the Buddha for such a long time. So Gopaka Moggallana asked Ananda many questions, such as, what type of meditation did the Buddha teach? And what did Gopaka Moggallana, what did Ananda reply? The Buddha only taught and praised four types of meditation. First jhana, second jhana, third jhana, fourth jhana. That's suttas. Told me the concept of jhana is the most controversial in today's Buddhism. No way. Every person who's read the suttas knows that they are eight factor of the Eightfold Path. Buddha never taught a sevenfold path. Eight factors. And it's clearly, and people these days actually, where the problem comes is that, first of all, from Vietnam, this is the United Congregation of Vietnamese Buddhists. Vietnam was an amazing country because they had Theravada Buddhists, Mahayana Buddhists, and they work together to make sure that everything just is together. And I thought it's so nice to see Theravada Buddhists, Mahayana Buddhists doing ceremonies together, teaching together, looking after one another. And the problem was, they said, teaching jhanas to lay people was just too difficult. So they actually made a resolution to ban teaching jhanas to lay people. They rescinded that many years later, but for a time they said that. It's too difficult. And please, even the case with Lady Sayadaw, L-E-D-I Sayadaw, was the one who, once the British had overrun Mandalay, which was almost like the spiritual heart of Burma at the time. He thought this is the end of Buddhism in Burma. And so this is saying in brief, I've got the full article, two books which were written about the phenomena of secular mindfulness and vipassana. Vipassana which was devoid of jhanas. And in this article he said, it was a reaction by Lady Sayadaw, noticing that the meditation of the jhanas was needed too much renunciation, too much letting go, and it was a bit scary. So not many people were doing meditation. So he started the vipassana tradition. So he could spread the jhana, spread meditation, which was, please excuse me, a second rank type meditation, not leading all the way, to as many people as possible to strengthen Buddhism, especially amongst the laity in Burma, as a reaction to my ancestors, colonialism. And he never meant it to be an alternative to the Eightfold Path. But when it went from him to his successor, and then to people like Mahasi Sayadaw, and even Mahasi Sayadaw, you know, the one who was very famous for his teachings on a vipassana and meditation. He always too, this was lay practice, a second class practice. And I remember just one of the monks in England, he visited the original Mahasi Sayadaw. Mahasi Sayadaw, Lady Sayadaw, that they take the name from the area, the temple where they teach. So, you know, if I was in the Burmese tradition, I'd be like Serpentine Sayadaw or Per Sayadaw. When I die, then maybe Bamali Sayadaw, he would be like Serpentine Sayadaw. So it's more like a title, but the Mahasi Sayadaw became very famous. Now he visited England once, and one of the monks over there, you know, took him for a walk through on Chitose Forest. I was talking about sort of, that's right, what was it, stillness or sound? I think the sound of silence. And Mahasi Sayadaw said, if there's any type of deep meditation, you don't hear any sound. Real samadhi doesn't have sound. Sound stops. And, you know, when that was reported to me, that was Mahasi Sayadaw knew jhanas, but thought it was too deep for lay people. And monks like me, just, you know, we're into equity. Maybe it's my upbringing, being a Westerner. You can't just say, oh, we're not going to teach you the same things as we teach the monks. That's not right. And even in the time of the Buddha, lay people could get jhanas. So that's, you know, the trying to give people an equal teachings. And also, oh, this is time, last one. I still also remember just going into a monastery in England, and one of the senior monks, as I was going into the reception area, he looked around and saw there was no one there. He grabbed me by the shoulder and he pulled me aside and he said, Ajahn Brahm, thank you for teaching jhanas. It was like I was giving out pornography or something. We had to keep it secret, yeah, under the table. But of course, times have changed now. And it's not a controversy at all. People know it's there. It's the Eightfold Path, for goodness sake. And anyway, I'll give some more information from the suttas tomorrow to confirm again the importance of the brilliant jhanas, and you can do it. You can do it, you won't all do it, but you can. Follow the instructions and see what happens. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Hope you don't mind a bit of controversy, because sometimes it gets me fired up and you get compassionate about teaching true Dhamma, real Dhamma, instead of second class, and to respect you, to teach you everything I know. Okay, so much for my promise to answer more questions. The trouble is, if you ask
If you write wrong questions, you get wrong answers. Oh, this is a good one. I want to become a bhikkhuni. Where and how do I have to start? Right over there. Have a talk with her. If you want to become a bhikkhuni. Yeah, it's better. So it's better, yeah.